gentlemen, one and all. I consider it a distinct honor to preside at this symposium, an honor which is as unmerited as it is distinct. I think the only reason that the systematics department asked me to preside here is to impress me with the fact that my sabbatical year terminated as of last Friday evening. If that was their purpose, it was altogether unnecessary, for I felt it when Dr. Fearbringer announced Friday evening at 10 minutes after 9, while I was standing unrobed and observing everything that was transpiring there, I heard him say, "Herewith ends the 120th year of this seminary." And there went my sabbatical year. So I had no part in any of the preparations for this symposium. Even the paper that I'll present before was prepared for me by a colleague covering the work that we are to study during this symposium, maybe during the next 5 years, I hope. And then also the statement of purpose. But it is now my pleasure to introduce to you the president of our seminary, Dr. Fearbringer.
Mr. Chairman, brethren, there's at least one other seminary president here. And I suppose he would agree with me, and perhaps all of you would, that being president of a seminary is somewhat of a unique position. In spite of that, I often feel that there are similarities with other professions and with other types of work. Very often I think that the work that I do is closely related to that of a mayor of a metropolitan city. I often amazed at the fact that the mayor of St. Louis, for instance, has to welcome all kinds of groups to this city and manages, at least usually, to convey a certain degree of sincerity in his welcome. Now, you'd be surprised at the various types of groups that come to Concordia Seminary and who need to be welcomed. All I need to indicate is that we have a large athletic field and a gymnasium, too, and I think you can imagine the types of groups that come here. And I feel that sometimes, too, I have to make sure that the sincerity of my welcome is apparent. But I don't think it's necessary on this occasion. We'll all agree that the task that has been set for this symposium is one that very much needs to be done, and needs to be done in America. We're deeply appreciative of the fact that in Europe, studies of this type have been made frequently, and that there are certain advantages to the European viewpoint. The accent on history is very heavy there, and I think there's much that we can learn from it. And while we do that, however, I feel that we need to make sure that we don't lose the benefits of the freedom, and to some extent also the freedom from history that we have in this country, and a combination of the two, that is acquiring a more of an accent on history and learning the value of knowing the way in which we have come, will be helpful to us all, particularly to us Lutherans here in the United States. So I trust that you all realize that I'm very happy to be able to welcome this group. And of course, as Professor Spitz pointed out a minute ago, this is the beginning of a new year, although our fiscal year begins on July 1st. The activities that we carry on after, immediately after commencement, are part of the year, so this is a very auspicious beginning for our 1958-59 fiscal year. And I therefore want to extend my sincere thanks to the Lutheran Brotherhood for helping to make this symposium possible, to the systematics department of our faculty and all those in it who particularly promoted this effort, because as president of the seminary, I am convinced it's going to be a very meaningful thing for us and will also enhance our reputation on the outside. I trust that all the facilities that we have here will be placed at your disposal. We have for some time been endeavoring in our library holdings to place some accent particularly on the 17th century, and I hope that we'll be able to continue that and really make that area one that can be studied to great advantage here. To that end also, we've been instrumental and helpful in organizing the Foundation for Reformation Research, which is just beginning its work, but which also will cover the 17th century, and which I hope then will be able to be of increasing help in future years as studies of this type are continued. Of course, at this point now, I'll have to mention in the language of television that this Foundation for Reformation Research has another sponsor, whose name, of course, we can't mention in this connection, but we are deeply grateful that also this endeavor could be organized during this past year, and now through the selection of Dr. Ernest Swiebert as director of the research, will, we trust, get off the ground soon and get into motion. Mr. Peepcorn informed me that he had originally hoped that as many as 20 would come to attend this symposium. I noticed from the list of advanced registrants that the number is almost at the 70 mark, and we expect that it may get to 80. If we were in a more superstitious age, of course, we'd say opposite omen. Don't mention 70 and 80 in connection with a symposium like this, because we don't want to attach any thoughts of possible decrepitude or near demise to the beginning of a venture like this. And yet I think it's probably good that just as we start something, we're also aware of the fact that the 90th Psalm has its meaning for any endeavor which we undertake in the life and in the work of the church. And that even though we have a good point of departure and our goal is fixed in our minds, if we don't start out in the right direction, we might engage in a 40 years wandering in the wilderness. So I trust and I have the confidence that whatever is said here, whatever is done here, will be said and done in the obedience of Jesus Christ, and that this will assure us then not only that we've started correctly, that we have the right goal in mind, but also that we're going to proceed properly and directly on our path to that goal. So with that, I think I've said enough to assure you of your welcome here and of the fact that I am eagerly looking forward to your discussions, and I trust that they'll be profitable to all of you, so profitable that other ventures of this kind will be forthcoming, possibly also again on our campus. Thank you.
I should mention here that during my Semitic recess, Dr. Arthur Carl Peepcorn was the acting chairman of our systematic department, and he, together with his committee, Dr. Robert D. Preuss and Dr. Irvin L. Luker, did the planning for this, together with the other members of our systematic department. And here is their thinking, the men and the works that should be considered in a symposium of this kind. They stated that ever since the death of Holatz in 1713 brought to an end the golden age of Lutheran Orthodox theology, this period in our church's history has come in variously for blame, praise, and neglect. The pessimistic appraisal of Christian Eberhard Weismann, Introductio in Memorabilia Ecclesiastica, Secunda, Stuttgart, 1719, becomes even blacker in the pages of Gottfried Arnold, Christian Tomasius, and J.G. Heinsius, and their strongly critical attitude has informed the general appraisal of this period down to the first quarter of this century. And it has not wholly disappeared, even in Lutheran circles. More favorable are the descriptions of Christian Junker, John Lawrence von Mosheim, John George Walch, but they did not succeed in counteracting the viewpoints propagated by Arnold and Tomasius, as the subsequent works of John Matthias Schreck, 1804, and G. J. Planck, 1831, witness. The mid-19th century brought a considerable revival of interest in orthodoxy on both sides of the Atlantic. In America, where Lutheran confessionalism won the victory over a Protestantizing Lutheranism in the conflict that Virgilius Firm has described as the crisis in American Lutheran theology in his book of that name, there were such developments as Paul Edward Gutheil's translation into English of Nicholas Hunnius's Epitome Credendorum, 1847, the publication of English translations of John Arndt's True Christianity and John Gerhardt's Meditatione Sacrae, an American edition of Christian Leber's Theologia Positiva Deutsch. We have a copy of that over here, and it pleased me especially to read there that Dr. Walter put that out in German because the students were complaining about the Latin. And Walter's American edition of John William Byers' Compendium Theologiae Positivae, greatly expanded by the addition in support of Byers' thesis of extensive quotations from Luther, the Lutheran symbols, and particularly of other Lutheran Orthodox dogmaticians. In Europe during the same period, Eduard Preuss was publishing his great editions of Chemnitz's Examen Concilii Tridentini, Gerhard's Loci Theologici, which required a second reprinting in 1885, and the second edition of Byers' Compendium, which he dedicated to the young Lutheran Church in America. In 1870, the Nertlingen edition of Nicholas Hunnius's Epitome was printed. The period also saw a considerable number of significant biographical works on the theologians of Lutheran orthodoxy. In 1853, E.L.T. Henke published the first volume of his two-volume Georg Calixtus, Und seine Zeit. In 1858, Becher published a German version of Fischer's famed Vita Gerhardi of 1723. The next 2 years each saw biographies of Telemann Hesuzius, Helmholtz in 1859, and C.A. Wilkins's in 1860. Preuss published his Vita Martini Chemnitii in 1861, and Hochfeld his Martin Chemnitz, Nach seinem Leben und Wirken in 1867. Krappe's biography of David Chytraeus came out in 1870, while Haase's Huterus Redivivus had achieved a 12th edition by 1883. Significant special studies included Trelgius' Vernunft und Offenbarung by Johannes Gerhardt und Melanchthon, 1891, and Max Koch's Der Ordo Salutis der Alten Lutherischen Dogmatik, 1899. The contribution of orthodoxy to ethics as essayed in Luthard's Geschichte der christlichen Ethik, two volumes, 1888 and 93. Important works of more general scope that devoted attention to the era of Lutheran orthodoxy included J.A. Dorner's Geschichte der Protestantischen Theologie, 1867, In the Train of Gasser's Geschichte der Protestantischen Dogmatik in four volumes, 1854 to 67, and of Schneckenburger's somewhat more specialized Vergleichende Darstellung des Lutherischen und Reformierten Kirchenbegriffs, 1855. From August Tullock's pen came Der Geist der Lutherischen Theologen in der Universität Wittenberg, 1852, Das Akademische Leben im 17. Jahrhundert, 1865, and the four volumes of his Vorgeschichte des Rationalismus, 1852-62. Coming to our own century, a German translation of Gerhard's Loci was published in 1906 and the succeeding years, and between 1937 and 41, Kind published Gerhard's Meditatione Sacrae in German, as vom Kampf und Trost der gläubigen Christenheit. German must be more popular than Latin because part of our German edition has disappeared out of Fritzlau. Latin's still there. In 1938, G. Huffman put out Balthasar Menzer's Handbüchlein with a good historical and theological introduction. V. Schulze published his biography of Philip Nicolai just 50 years ago this year, and Hans H. Weisgerber published the first installment of his work on Aegidius Hunnius in the 1955 Jahrbuch of the Gesellschaft der Hessische Kirchengeschichte. It covers the period of Hunnius's Marburg professorship, 1576 to 92. In 1905, Armand Rust wrote his dissertation at Jena on the polemic des, die Polemik des Martin Chemnitz gegen das Konzil von Trient. 2 years later, H.G. Weber published his Die Philosophische Scholastik oder Scholastik des Deutschen Protestantismus im Zeitalter der Orthodoxie. The next year, Weber came out with Der Einfluss der protestantischen Schulphilosophie auf die Orthodox Lutherische Dogmatik. Karl Heims' Das Gewissheitsproblem in der Systematischen Theologie bis zu Schleiermacher came out in 1911. A decade later, Peter Peterson published his Geschichte der Aristotelischen Philosophie im protestantischen Deutschland. Paul Althaus investigated the devotional literature of the 17th century in his Forschungen zur Evangelischen Erbauungsliteratur, 1927. And in 1939, W. Burkert wrote his Breslau dissertation, only partly published, on John Gerhardt als Erbauungsschriftsteller. In the area of ethics, there should be noted Gustav Heinicke's Studien zur Altprotestantischen Ethik, 1902, and the important fourth volume of Dietrich's Geschichte der Ethik, 1932, half of which is devoted to orthodoxy. Hans Leube has given us the Reform, die Reformidee in der Deutschen Lutherischen Kirche zur Zeit der Orthodoxie, 1924, and volume 1 of Calvinismus und Luthertum im Zeitalter der Orthodoxie, 1928. In 1931, Schenke wrote Der Kirchengedanke, Johann Gerhardt und seiner Zeit, and 2 decades later, Bengt Hägglund issued his Lund dissertation of 1951, Die Heilige Schrift und ihre Bedeutung in der Theologie Johann Gerhardt. Aegidius Hunnius' role at Regensburg is discussed in W. Hepp's Das Regensburger Religionsgespräch von 1601. This came out in 1928. Lindstrom's Philip Nicolai's Verständnis des Christentums dates from 1931. At Göttingen in 1952, Streisand wrote on Theologie und Kirchenpolitik by Jakob Andrea. Gaining increasing attention is the Edinburgh doctoral dissertation of a member of our department, Robert Preuss's The Inspiration of Scripture, first published in 1955 and shortly to come out in a second British edition. Congratulations to my colleague. Where is it? Back there. There'll be more editions after that. More general works with significant evaluations of orthodoxy are O. Ritschl's four-volume Dogmengeschichte des Protestantismus, 1908-27, and the opening sections of Immanuel Hirsch's Geschichte der Neueren Evangelischen Theologie, 1951, as well as the pertinent chapters in Navy Hike's History of Christian Thought. Meanwhile, Scotland has given us Andrew Lane Drummond's German Protestantism since Luther, 1951, of which the opening chapters are devoted to the 17th century. The ecumenical movement is focusing new attention on colleagues to whom Friedrich Wilhelm Kantenbach devotes the final section in Das Ringen die Einheit der Kirche im Jahrhundert der Reformation, 1957. Now, the influence of orthodoxy upon the 20th century. Number one, via Heinrich Schmidt's Dogmatik, translated by Hay and Jacobs. And I'm sorry to say that it's hard to get that volume. I haven't been able to get it yet in the translation. We have it over here in Pritzlaff, of course. maybe someone will sell me his copy. Number two, via Walter, Pieper and Heinicke upon the Synodical Conference. Now, the overall importance of the era. Here we have the appraisal. Point one, American Lutheranism took its theological form more from 17th century orthodoxy than from the Lutheranism of any previous or subsequent century. Number two, the 17th century saw the emergence of the beginnings of Pietism, which also exerted a profound influence upon American Lutheran theology and practice. Number three, the 17th century fixed for the future many of the basic attitudes of Lutherans toward the Roman Catholic as well as toward the Zwinglian Calvinist and the Continental Anabaptist independent traditions. Four, the contributions of this period to Lutheran hymnology is of very great significance. Five, the influence upon Christian mysticism by some of the Lutherans of this period has been very great, notably John Arndt, and as representatives of a somewhat less normal type of Lutheranism, Jakob Behme and John Valentin Weigel. Projects in this era now underway are shortly to be begun. Number one, six volumes of the theology of Chemnitz and Gerhardt to be published by Augsburg Publishing House under the general editorship of Hermann A. Preuss. Where is he? Oh, there he is. Will you stand? Edmund Smith, thank you. Both of whom are appearing on this program. Smith. Where is he? Not here, eh? Thank you. Number two, an open-minded project that will translate a variety of theological works by Lutheran authors 17th century under the sponsorship of the Committee on Scholarly Research and the General Literature Board of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod has been initiated with a decision approved by the Board of Directors of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod to prepare a scholarly translation of Chemnitz's Examen Concilii Tridentini. Number three, the series of graduate studies of the School of Graduate Studies of Concordia Seminary will include, according to present plans, an English translation of the opening gun in the Lutheran polemic against the Roman Catholic Church, Chemnitz's Theologiae Jesuitarum Precipua Capita. I think the man who will be responsible for that is in our midst too already, or isn't he? Or will be here. Number four, the newly founded Institute for Reformation Research has indicated its interest in the era of Orthodoxy as an integral part of its overall concern. Now the purpose of this present symposium. One, to begin the exploration of the implications of 17th century Lutheranism for our times and our church's contemporary mission. Two, to consider the horizontal as well as the vertical dimensions of the 17th century Lutheranism with a view to a better understanding of the real character of Lutheranism as a historic phenomenon. Number three, to lay the foundation for the creation of an interest group of theologians, exegetes, philosophers, and historians whose professional responsibilities or personal interests direct them toward the Lutheran theology and culture of the 17th century. It is considered that in the very nature of the case, the interested individuals will be Lutherans primarily, but current indications already suggest that members of other communions, Anglicans, Roman Catholics, and Reformed, will be interested and can make a contribution to the group. Four, to consider the feasibility of a moderately long-term program, say 5 years, of integrated study of the 17th century Lutheranism and to plan for its financing and execution. Five, to create interest in the Lutheranism of the 17th century in as wide a circle as possible. Thank you, Dr. Peepcorn, and your helpers, your colleagues who have worked this thing out and have made it so easy for me to present it. Now, this is it. Do you have any remarks to add to this, Mr. Peepcorn, or your committee, anyone? This covers it. So then we may proceed, and the next presentation will be the Lutheran theologians of the 17th century as philosophers. The Reverend A.C.M. Alain of Northwestern Lutheran Theological Seminary, Minneapolis, Minnesota, will present this to us, and our discussion leader will be the Reverend Lawrence Wunderlich of our own seminary here. Dr. Alain, please.
Well, gentlemen, I want to start my presentation with a disclaimer. There appeared in the Minneapolis Star Saturday, a notice of the four Twin City theologians that were to participate in this symposium. I want to warn you, I'm no theologian at all. You say you'll discover that for yourself later on, but it's just as well that you know it in advance. My own area of specialization has lain in a region quite far removed from theology. My training has been in secular philosophy. You may ask, and of course it's true, I'm teaching at a theological institution. What's my function there? Well, my connection with that institution, to start out with, was purely accidental. It was an unavoidable fill-in under a difficult situation in which that particular school found itself. And after that, it was discovered that my services were desirable for the purpose of teaching straight philosophy. The colleges fall down on their job. And in addition to these projects, I have been carrying on some investigations and doing some work in what I conceive to be a necessary field of activity in our own day. That is to say, the theological garbage heaps, the study of especially of the non-Christian sectarian movements. Well, all of these personal data may be of no great significance, but I think you ought to be forewarned as to what to expect. As I said before, I'm no theologian. When it comes to such matters, my training is entirely that of the parish priest and not of the specialist. Now, to assert that philosophy and theology are not identical would obviously be unnecessary in addressing myself to the present group, but to remind you that there are vast areas of common interest shared by these two disciplines is probably not superfluous. Living as we do in a time when reason is often ridiculed and up-to-the-minute theologians present highly rationalized arguments in favor of anti-rational views, we need to remind ourselves that philosophy is inescapable. The moment we reflect critically upon our experiences and beliefs, we begin to philosophize. And even if someone says, well, my position is to have no philosophy, that becomes his philosophy. So it's the one thing you can't escape the moment you try to communicate. I stress that, as I've indicated, for the reason indicated above, namely that we have to listen to so many people tell us that, after all, the desirable thing to do in theology in particular, and in life in general, is to be anti-rational. And then we have a long, highly rationalized presentation as to why we ought to be anti-rational. There are too many of the, how would I say, of Tertullian, Redivivus, credo quia absurdum est. It's absurd, therefore I believe. Well, actually, no one can take that very seriously. In fact, Tertullian, who was very anti-philosophical, cribbed very heavily, among others, from the Stoics. Now, while we thus recognize the inevitability of philosophy, we need to recall that there is no Christian philosophy per se. Some points of view, for example, materialism, naturalism, agnosticism, obviously, are not compatible with the Christian faith. Others, however, are. Augustine, Anselm, Peter Abelard, Thomas Aquinas, Descartes, Berkeley, and Kierkegaard can all claim a place within the Christian framework. Bruno, Hobbes, Fichte, Schopenhauer, Marx, Spencer, and Russell cannot. Still others, of whom we may take Kant and James as random examples, have propounded systems more or less compatible with the Christian faith. All of this is a commonplace matter, but just because it is just the ordinary facts that are overlooked when zeal for a particular position becomes dominant. Philosophy asks fundamental questions about the nature of reality, of value, of man and his destiny. The Christian faith supplies answers, well, please remember, not merely for the purpose of providing academic answers, but providing a way of life which will embody these answers. Certainly, the Christian faith is not primarily intellectual in its nature, but there is an intellectual element which I think we need to re-emphasize again as having a very necessary position in that faith. Now, the Christian faith, we said, supplies these answers, and theology attempts to systematize them. Now, the question that philosophy asks, are these rationally defensible, or at least can they be shown to lie beyond rational criticism? It is here that the philosopher and the theologian's work overlap, and it is here that the scholastic, whether medieval or 17th century, has labored. We may criticize his often demonstrated narrowness and his intolerance, but we must admit that his objective was laudable. I'm well aware that we are often vociferously reminded that the Christian faith cannot be propositionalized. Well, either that is saying something obvious, or else it's saying something that is perfectly stupid. To be sure, no statement is the equivalent of the reality for which it stands. I might say parenthetically, or dogs can't be propositionalized either. So what? I stress this because I'm heartily tired of hearing both students and some very learned men running around telling each other and myself that, oh, the Christian faith can't be propositionalized. So what again? To be sure, no statement is the equivalent of the reality for which it stands, but neither can we communicate in any meaningful way without recourse to propositions. Even the statement noted above, namely that Christianity cannot be propositionalized, is itself a proposition. The 17th century has sometimes been spoken of as the Lutheran Church's medieval period. The remark is usually intended to be opprobrious, suggesting that this was an age of brutality during which the theologians, having the upper hand, fought among themselves, persecuted dissenters, and distorted or trivialized the Christian faith. The defects of the age are undeniable. They do not spring from the basic objectives of these thinkers, however, but rather from the social conditions of the times. Of course, we need to remember one thing, too, about the 17th century. It was an age in which theology was taken seriously. That can scarcely be said of our own time. We take our politics and economics very seriously, but theology, after all, ain't a person entitled to believe what he wants to. That's the good American way, even within the framework of a particular denomination. So we can howl to high heaven if somebody who denies the fundamentals is given the boot which he so richly deserves. That's said with malice aforethought. Sought by means of deductive logic to produce an all-inclusive theological system on that basis. That, though true enough, would be an oversimplification of our project, just as a detailed study of their philosophical technique applied to all problems would be prevented by its magnitude. We shall have to content ourselves with a brief discussion of their procedures in dealing with certain representative questions of the philosophy of religion. Before doing this, however, a brief presentation of a few biographical data are in order. This is stuff that I'm sure most of you are familiar with, but that becomes necessary as a part of the sequence. Abraham Calo Calovius, 1612 to 1685, sometime professor at Wittenberg, is often spoken of as the staunchest defender of Orthodox Lutheranism against any and all critics within and without the church. You might note, interestingly enough, in passing, that at least in one respect, this man didn't embody the Aristotelian principle of Mede in Agon. He was married no less than six times, the last occasion being after he was in his 70s, marrying the daughter of his colleague, Quenstedt. Rather unique situation in which man felt older than his father-in-law. If that's an embodiment of the Aristotelian principle, I'm not so sure that I know what the latter is. Anyhow, that's beside the point. John Gerhardt, 1582 to 1637, professor at Jena, though equally a champion of Orthodox Lutheranism, was of a far more ironic disposition than Calovius. Matthew Hoffenreffer, 1561 to 1619, professor at Tübingen, sought to use the then newer method in philosophy, that is Cartesianism, in his exposition of Lutheranism, and I'm sure you will hear more of that from Dr. Hillerdahl. His work became popular and for a considerable time served as the official textbook in the Church of Sweden. And indeed, his attempted justification for the king, the secular ruler, as the guardian over religion and morals, the supreme guardian over religion and morals, is something that we are told that Charles XII had practically memorized. That may tell us something about the king, that period and the influence of theology on the politics of the 17th century Scandinavia. David Olatius, 1648 to 1713, pastor in Pomerania, is generally spoken of as the last of the great Lutheran Orthodox dogmaticians of this period. Leonhard Hutter, 1563 to 1616, another Wittenberg professor, has been designated as the second edition of Luther. The justification of the label is problematical. John Quenstedt, 1685, is unique among these persons in that he actually had served as a professor of philosophy at Wittenberg, becoming a teacher of theology only in 1660. The designation attached to him, the bookkeeper of Orthodox Lutheranism, suggests faithfulness, scrupulous carefulness, and lack of originality. Of course, we can take consolation in the fact that there are really very few original ideas in this world anyway, and probably if we hadn't encountered, that's the word, with a completely unique idea, we wouldn't be able to recognize it. Consideration of these champions of Orthodoxy would be incomplete without a brief mention of two prominent opponents. John Valentin Andrea, 1586 to 1654, grandson of one of the co-authors of the Formula of Concord, emphasized ethics and discipline as well as doctrine. Though not going to the same length as the man about to be mentioned, he stressed the desirability of mutual recognition among denominations on the basis of the fundamental Christian belief. We should, of course, call to mind the fact that back in those days, the multiplicity of denominations was not as great as it is at the present time. They were thinking only in terms of three or four. The desirability of mutual recognition among denominations on the basis of the fundamental Christian beliefs. Difficulty, of course, arises in determining what is fundamental. Probably haven't quite settled in our own day either, I dare say. His pseudonymous polemic against the mystical vagaries of his own time has undeservedly secured for him the reputation of founding the Rosicrucians. Another warning, better not write anything in an ironical line. Some fathead is going to misunderstand it and misapply it. George Calixtus, 1586 to 1656, professor at Helmstedt, deplored the acrimonious polemic of his own day and became himself the object of bitter opposition, especially from Calovius. Calixtus, usually associated with the term syncretism, has been accused of both crypto-Romanism and crypto-Calvinism. He argued that a distinction must be made between fundamental, that is to say, essential to salvation, and non-fundamental teachings. On the basis of the former, the different denominations should recognize each other. His division of doctrine into antecedents as religious facts that can be known by reason without divine revelation, constituents, the true fundamentals, the basic matters of faith ascertainable through revelation alone, and the consequence, that is, deductions from the two foregoing, is not only interesting, but it also shows how, from the standpoint of philosophic method, similar techniques were used by the Orthodox and their supposedly more or less heterodox opponents. Concerning the relationship of faith and reason, of theology and philosophy, the old dogmaticians have much to say that makes them personae non gratae to the contemporary exponents of a blatant pedeism, as well as to some of their own contemporaries. Daniel Hoffman, who died in 1611, had echoed the sentiments of Averroes and certain nominalists when he said, philosophy is hostile to theology, and what is true in philosophy is false in theology. To this, Calovius replied that philosophy is not opposed to theology and is by no means to be rejected as brutish, terrene, impure, diabolical, we thus demonstrate. One, because the true agrees with the true and does not antagonize it. But what is known by the light of nature is no less true than what is revealed in the scriptures. Two, because philosophical, natural and philosophical knowledge has its origin from God. Three, because philosophy leads us to a knowledge of God. That's the quotation from his Systema Locorum Theologicorum. The accent may not be rightly placed. Some of our students are tired of hearing the classical language pronounced right. If it's really French accent, then that's as good as any other accent. We don't know how the old Romans spoke anyway. Then, from the same work, we must distinguish between a real and apparent contradiction. The maxims of philosophy and the conclusions of theology do not really contradict each other, but only appear to do so. For they either do not discuss the same subject, or they do not describe the same mode, condition, or relation of it. In other words, a statement must be seen in its proper context. There are different universes of discourse. So also Quenstedt. Philosophy and the principle of reason, direct quotation, are not indeed contrary to theology, but there is a vast difference between these things that are revealed in Scripture and those which are known by the light of nature. The principle of reason, no one rejects. The formal principle of reason, no one rejects. Its material principle, no wise man accepts. Others could be cited with the same result. To sum up, divine revelation in the realm of the supernatural must be the basis of faith. In matters pertaining to the natural, human reason must judge. Rightly understood, the conflict between them is impossible. Does Gerhardt? Sound reason is not opposed to the faith if we accept as such that which is truly and properly so called, namely that which does not transcend the limits of its sphere and does not arrogate to itself decisions in regard to the mysteries of faith, or which, enlightened by the Word and sanctified by the Holy Spirit, does not follow its own principles in the investigation of the mysteries of the faith, but the light of the Word and the guidance of the Holy Spirit. In other words, we have here a sharp line of demarcation drawn between the natural and the supernatural. The latter is made up of mysteries beyond, but not contrary to, reason. Hence, the laws of abstract thought are applicable in all cases. There is no repudiation of the law of identity, of non-contradiction, and of excluded middle set forth here. In fact, if you repudiate those principles, like running around and yelping, "Well, we're not slaves to Aristotle," you're not going to be able to communicate meaningfully. Whenever you talk to someone, you're assuming that the thing is what it is, and that it isn't itself and not itself at the same time in the same context. I'm tired of hearing that too, because again, by liberation from Aristotle, some can assert that, "Oh yes, we believe everything in the creed," and then we proceed to demythologize them a la mode Guzman, and end up in the glorious Isle of Nowhere. Because we can't accept the three-story universe, of course, we'll have to conclude that there isn't any up or down, so we just walk out of the window here. I wouldn't recommend it. Theology is no mere rejection of these, is no more a rejection of these than it would be a suspension of the laws of mathematics, because of the fact that God is triune. God is not one in the same sense as he is three. The fundamental problem of any philosophy of a religion is, of course, the doctrine of God. While emphasizing the inadequacy of non-revelational knowledge of the deity, and this which follows is a quotation from Quench says, "The natural knowledge of God is not sufficient to secure salvation, nor can anyone be redeemed by it alone." Nevertheless, the 17th century dogmaticians follow the lead of the ancients and the main succession of medieval thinkers. Man has an innate knowledge of God. In support of this is quoted Romans 1:19 and 2:14 and 15. Moreover, the very fact that man has a capacity for distinguishing good and evil, and that he has a feeling of responsibility and a conscience, constitutes further indications of God's existence. It might be interesting to note just in passing that this latter argument is one that has been made, of which C.S. Lewis has made extensive use in his little book, The Case for Christianity, the first half. The very fact that we recognize the distinction between good and evil, which everyone recognizes, will itself indicate the existence of God. Man also has a natural knowledge of God which is derived from observation of the external world and from the events of history. A detailed discussion of these well-known arguments I deem unnecessary at this point. This knowledge of God is not purely theoretical. It has a practical objective. Says Calovius, "The use of natural knowledge of God is one, pedagogical, for seeking after the true God who has manifested himself through the scriptures in the church. Two, hydeutical, for directing moral and external discipline, both within and without the church. Three, didactic, because it contributes to the exposition and illustration of the scriptures if rightly employed." In all this, it is necessary to bear in mind that man's natural capacities have been impaired by the fall. And let's remind ourselves, it shouldn't be necessary, but it's well to do so, that these 17th century theologians took the fact of the fall for granted. The fall wasn't merely a recapitulation of universal human experience, recognizing that we are living in a world that is unsatisfactory and that we are confronted with decisions. Not at all. They believe that the fall must be in taking place. Of course, they were naive, naturally. They're not enlightened to believe it. Don't hold that against them. Man's natural capacities have been impaired by the fall. Hence, what we have is but a faint recollection of what once was. Gerhardt speaks of his knowledge as, to quote, "sparks and scintillations of that clear light which shone with full splendor in the mind of man before the fall." The doctrine of the Trinity provides another situation in which these thinkers made use of their previously noted techniques. The doctrine itself is a mystery. However, once given in Revelation, it can be shown to be not absurd. Among Christians, instructed in the Word of God and embracing by faith the mystery of the Trinity, this can be proved by natural reasons. Another quotation from 26. We might pause to note here that the dogmaticians could have gone further than they did, while the doctrine of the Trinity cannot be demonstrated after the manner of a geometrical proposition. It can be shown to provide an answer to a question about God's nature, that a Unitarian conception of the deity leaves an even greater mystery. A detailed discussion of the application of these methods to all areas of theological knowledge is, as has already been said, out of question. It is of particular interest, however, to note their treatment of the problem of human personality or soul. The latter, says Gerhardt, can be shown to be probably immortal by natural reason, and in support of this, arguments from Plato and the older scholastics are reduced. The basic proof, however, is to be found in Revelation. They believe, of course, in the natural immortality of the soul, but it is such because of God's creation and not because of anything inhering in the soul per se. And man, of course, does not have the same kind of immortality that God has. I mention that, too, because, of course, the doctrine of the soul is something else that is being called in question lightly, very widely, I should say, in some circles in our own days, when psychopanicism is being revived. While you have a rightful re-emphasis on the significance of the resurrection, I sometimes think it has been worked for very other reasons, which I think is unnecessary to specify here. Summing up our rather superficial survey, we can say that the 17th century dogmaticians were supernaturalists. That is to say, there is nature and there is supernature. There's no question about that in their minds. And I don't think there can be any question about that in anyone's mind who professes the Christian faith. God, angels, about which we hear only very apologetically in this demythologized age. God, angels, man as a spiritual entity. These were to be sharply distinguished from other forms of existence, and as such, they are not subject to the so-called laws of nature. By the laws of nature here, I mean simply observed uniformity. Because, of course, that's all that we have in the scientific conception of laws of nature. They were, as to say, the 17th century dogmaticians, they were, accordingly, metaphysical dualists. Now, please note I said metaphysical, not theological. Math and spirit are ultimate realities reducible to no other substance. They were rationalized by means of reason, though the latter in common with all things human has been corrupted by the fall. By means of reason, man can obtain reliable knowledge of natural phenomena, and indeed of some, by deduction of certain supernatural facts. Man can be regenerated also by the same instrument on the basis of revelation. Man can, man regenerated, I should say, can also by the same instrument on the basis of revelation arrive at reliable corollaries and conclude. We may deplore their intolerance and their polemical absence. And we merely regret our failure to recognize that there is yet more light to break forth from the Word as a student and on the basis of experience of the limitations of human reason. And as I've told my students, both at the university and at the seminary, very often, while we recognize the limitations of human reason, we have not therefore any carte blanche for behaving irrationally or imagine that we are pleasing God by being stupid. Let's remember that all things human, reason, but certainly not excluding other things, are fallible. And as I've told them too, unless your experience has been vastly different from mine, I can say quite truthfully, I've never gotten into trouble yet by following my reason, but into plenty of it by allowing my feelings to